This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
With me in the SCANA studio today are Fritz Hamer, who is the historian at the Confederate Relic Room and Military Museum, and Mike Bonner, who is a professor at USC Lancaster, professor of history. And we're going to be talking about a book that they edited, South Carolina in the Civil War and Reconstruction Eras. And it's a collection of essays from the archives of the South Carolina Historical Association. So, first of all, gentlemen, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And there are lots of organizations in South Carolina. So let's explain to our listeners what the South Carolina Historical Association is all about.
Well, it's an organization that goes back to 1931 with the main plan of bringing teachers of history and professors of history in the state to come together annually to do papers and to critique each other and help promote South Carolina history and history in general. When you see the organization South Carolina Historical Association, you have a tendency to think, rightly so, I suppose, that it does South Carolina history and maybe South, but it does much more than that. We have Europeanists, and every year we have a professional meeting in March, and we have sessions, of course, on American history, South Carolina history, but also on European.
Okay. And Mike, how did you get to USC Lancaster?
Well, I'm a North Carolinian. After I finished my PhD at University of California, Riverside, I was an adjunct at the University of Arizona for 4 years, and I eventually came to a tenure-track position at USC Lancaster in 2011.
Okay. And you have been an officer in the association?
I joined the board in 2012, and I met Fritz.
Okay.
There was some talk at the first board meeting that it's the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. Why don't we have a book out about the Civil War? And I thought, well, we better get moving because the sesquicentennial is almost behind us. So Fritz and I got to talking about the articles that have been published since the 1930s and how it might make a good compilation. And he and I met at a cafe and started to go through the ones we thought were worthy.
Well, and 1931, I think it's interesting, the date, historically, and that given the poverty of South Carolina and the fact that colleges were barely hanging on by their fingernails, that a group of historians not only formed an organization, but actually began publishing a journal annually. And this is before what people consider the venerable Southern Historical Association even got organized, and certainly before it was publishing. So it was starting here, and it really was a bold venture. And I think it's important to point out it wasn't just college professors. It was to include teachers of history at the high school level as well as colleges. Over the years, that high school teacher membership has waxed and waned, but I know now that you've been really making a recruiting effort to bring those folks once again back into the fold.
We're really trying, and we also, you know, historians, you know, if you want to call them that, amateurs, that you know, devote a lot of time to research, we encourage them. And we've had a few of those in my tenure of the last 25 or 30 years that come in. And we're trying to broaden that base.
Well, I think you just say historians. You don't have to have a PhD to be able to write some very good history. Look at the folks in the 19th century.
Oh, exactly.
Not just in the United States, but in Europe. Mm-hmm. It was the Germans that gave us the PhD.
Von Ranke and his people.
Okay. 1931 is also an interesting date because the study of the Civil War, of course, it began, as we know, in 1866 and went through a number of iterations. And there are terms we might use in the course of our conversation, like the Dunning School and what have you. We might want to explain to people about the ups and downs. And let's just start at, not in any detail, but right after the war, you've got people in the North writing from pretty much the virtuous cause of the Union and that kind of thing. And you've got Southern defenders, I don't want to say apologists, but that's what historians would call them, and the rise of the lost cause. So let's take it from there up to 1931.
When I was thinking about how to arrange these articles, obviously chronological made sense. But as I started to work on the introduction, I thought, well, there's going to be a lot of different interpretations from 1931 to 2010. And I actually anticipated seeing some 1930s and 40s articles being the remnants of the Lost Cause school, rebirth of the Lost Cause, so to speak, in the 1930s with Douglas Southall Freeman and that whole school. But I was surprised that that was not the case. I was very pleasantly surprised to see very objective pieces from the very first articles that we looked at. You may notice that I mentioned Peter Novick's book, That Noble Dream, in the introduction. I kind of used that as a roadmap to think about the different schools from the 1930s.
Let's talk about that just because not everybody will have read The Noble Dream.
Okay. He's just an author who tracked, I think the book came out in 1988, he tracked the main schools of interpretive thought from, really he went back into the 1800s, but since we were focused on the 20th century, I thought that was more appropriate since that's when these articles were published. In the 1950s, he talks about the consensus school.
What was the noble dream?
The noble dream is objectivity. And historians shoot for it, but we are all trained that we will never attain it. But we still need to try to shoot for it. It still should be the goal, hence the dream. But I wanted to make sure that these pieces were not taken out of their context. And that's one reason I focused on the different schools. Particularly in the 1930s and 40s, historians, through no fault of their own, were writing before the civil rights movement and the rise of social history. We were worried that we might see a wide variation of unobjective pieces in these articles.
Well, rather than unobjective, I mean, in their time period, they thought it was objective. Now, I think economic issues, issues of democracy, all of that, and nationalism, all of that was part of the scene.
Certainly. And we're all victims of our period, right? We all bring our baggage, our daily baggage, to the work we do as historians. But I wanted to put these articles in the context of their larger milieu.
Okay.
And actually, the first one that we picked from 1938 was a very well-written article about women's aid groups to Confederate soldiers. It was a fascinating piece.
Mm-hmm. And who wrote that?
James Welch Patton. So you have the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and then when you get into the 60s and 70s with the centennial of the Civil War and approaching the centennial of Reconstruction, the contemporary events like the Civil Rights Movement and the rise of social history really start to see a sea change in the ways that some of these topics are handled. And I think it's really fascinating.
Wasn't there an older South Carolinian, Francis Butler Simpkins, who published earlier than this, but along with Woody, Simpkins and Woody, Reconstruction in South Carolina?
Certainly, and I think that's 1936, and that was really one of the first books to start to deconstruct the Dunning School, which had been...
All right, now tell us, we haven't really met, we've talked about the Dunning School. What's the Dunning School?
The Dunning School was a professor at Columbia who was... Basically, his interpretation was Reconstruction was a disaster across the board, that the white redemptions who came back in the 1870s in South Carolina with Hampton in 1876-77 saved the South from political, economic disaster.
And in matters of race?
And, of course, we're talking about African Americans. They were not capable of political engagement, and therefore it was important for the white upper class to keep control.
All right. Fritz, I think it's important that you mentioned where Professor Dunning was. He was at Columbia University. He was an Ivy Leaguer. So his interpretation of history, Civil War and Reconstruction, was pretty much a national interpretation, not just a white Southern interpretation.
Exactly. Yes, very much so. And his... philosophy was transferred to all of his graduate students and continued to be the preeminent interpretation of Reconstruction, certainly in most places up into the 1950s and 60s.
So then Francis Butler Simpkins, native of Edgefield County, South Carolina, teaching at a little school up in Virginia, and his colleague who was teaching in North Carolina, come up with something very different in the 1930s.
Yeah, and that's something that needs to be further investigated. But, I mean, they looked at data, all kinds of data, not just one side, I think, and came up with a very different overall view. You know, Reconstruction was a rough period, but there were parts of it that had some promise, at least early on. And they look at the fact that the white redemptionists, as they retook control, used any means at their disposal to put down these radical Republicans, African Americans, scalawags, carpetbaggers.
John Hammond Moore has actually used the term greenback scalawags because there were any number of merchants in South Carolina of prominent families who were more than willing to make money off the Reconstruction regime.
Oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. So Simpkins saw a different way of looking at the data. And I think he also went beyond some of what Dunning was looking at to determine that, Reconstruction was a much more complicated period than Dunning would have us believe in his students.
And Mike, if I remember correctly, Simpkins and Woody were very, I don't want to say enamored, but they focused in on the Constitution of 1868 and its contributions to South Carolina. And one of the things people forget, of course, now Simpkins knew this after having done his work on Tillman, and that is that there's more of the 1868 Constitution in the 1895 Constitution than people want to admit.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1868 Constitution was taken almost totally from the Ohio Constitution. So the Constitution of which we still live, it's pretty much grounded in the Midwest. That's where it came from.
How ironic. Huh?
Okay, so we got Mr. Dunning. And I must say, as an undergraduate in the early 1960s, even when you looked at general American histories like Morrison and Cominger, their interpretation of the Civil War and Reconstruction is still semi-Dunning-esque, if I can say that. It passed over the whole question of any positive good. And they really wanted to get out of the Civil War as quickly as they could and get into industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
But that began to change, certainly, in the 60s. But In some of the essays here, it began to change in South Carolina before then.
Fritz? Yeah, there's a more objective – well
– quit using the term objective.
Good point. There is a different way of looking at Reconstruction that we begin to see in the 50s. And some of these articles in the 1960s that we've republished, Robert Moore –
Robert Moore, for many years, professor of history at Columbia College.
Yes, and a longtime member of the association. But he, in the 60s, is looking at these issues in a different light than the Dunningites, and looking at, for example, how Andrew Johnson's presidency and its interpretation has changed from almost the time he left office into the 1960s, from one of total negativity as a terrible president to historians in the 20s looking at him as a more positive light, as someone who was trying to rehabilitate the South and bring it back in, and then to the 60s where he's turning into another villain in the minds of most historians at the time.
Okay. Let's have some other examples. The one essay that really caught my attention is Lowry Ware's article on Isaac Hayne and the Executive Council, which ran South Carolina in the early years of the war. Doesn't have a lot of friends. I mean, if you believe in states' rights and all of that, the Executive Council was the dictatorship of five men. Mike?
Really four men, because they were very concerned about Francis Pickens. But it is sort of a, I don't want to say like a French Revolution.
Triumvirate.
Yeah, right. That ran the state in response to the military success in Port Royal in November of 1861. The state was threatened.
But you also got things that had nothing to do with that. You know, the Great Fire in Charleston got tossed in as an example of bad government. But remember, this is a government that actually was going to do a census of household silverware, gold, jewelry, that kind of thing. Wanted to have a passport to go from Charleston to Columbia, Greenville to, I mean, South Carolina seceded on individual rights, and wow, this group comes right in.
I've found in some other cases, too, that South Carolina was the leader in some rather authoritarian ideas as well. South Carolina had a state conscription before the Confederacy had conscription.
Well, you know why they had to have it, don't you? It's because they couldn't fill their volunteer quotas.
But the Confederate model was largely based on South Carolina's, and the 20 slave clause that was so controversial in the fall of 1862, that has origins in South Carolina as well. So that's a great article. There's so many good articles in this book.
And one of the other things that people don't realize is that before the end of the war, if you were a plain farmer or a planter, there was the agricultural tithe that took 10%. I actually saw a book kept by a farmer in Lexington County, and he was talking about the amount of wheat that he had raised, and he said 10% for the government. And I think he referred to it as the government's tithe.
Well, I mean, you know, look at some of the leaders of South Carolina, like James Henry Hammond, you know, who had been this radical secessionist from very early on. I mean, he rails against the Confederate government from the formation of the state and can't stand this centralization that he's been railing against from the 1830s.
Well, Boyce and others in the Confederate Congress were leaders of the anti-Davis movement. In fact, most of the newspapers in South Carolina were anti-Confederate. You know, this gets to be ironic as, of course, after the war, when Davis becomes a Southern hero, particularly in South Carolina, we still have a Jefferson Davis holiday optional in South Carolina. But during the war, the people, the whites of South Carolina, did not like Jefferson Davis at all.
No, no.
Except for Mary Chestnut.
Yeah. Yeah, she seemed to have a soft spot for him, I guess. After seceding and having this idea of a decentralized government, it's very clear if you're going to fight a war in the 1860s, you've got to have centralization. You've got no hope. And that's what Davis was quickly realizing, and even South Carolina was realizing it. But so many of the radicals who had pushed the South and South Carolina to secession wouldn't accept it for some reason, even though the reality was you can't win a war in a decentralized fashion.
Well, in fact, Hammond fought with the South Carolina government because they were requisitioning slave labor to build fortifications. And he basically, I don't know whether he actually sued, but he was thinking about suing the state government to prevent that happening. And then there's that wonderful story from upstate of the woman from the Piedmont Farmer who said they had come to requisition slaves, and she said, "They've taken my husband and they're not going to get anything else."
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
So this is coming out. To me, it's interesting way before the changes in national historiographical trends.
Right. It's almost as if some of these articles anticipated the next wave of scholarship. Mm-hmm. We did have a larger pool to select from, so we did eliminate some from contention.
Okay. Well, just out of curiosity, from 1931 to 2010, and the reason you chose 2010 is the wonderful website the Association has, everything since 2010 is on the web, so people can look at the articles.
That's correct.
The others are published. So how many articles did you have to go through? And I realize you have South Carolina history from the proprietary period to the Depression, but just as a guess.
I would say, I mean, we have in here, I should know off the top of my head, what, 24 articles?
Right. And we probably started out with 40 that were under consideration. There were some that we eliminated.
Now, why did you eliminate some?
I can speak to the one that I really wanted in the book, but at the end of the day, we were running long on pages, and it was a comparison of libraries, actually.
Oh, yeah.
between the one that was destroyed at the beginning of the First World War.
In Belgium.
And a library during the Civil War.
William Gilmore Sims.
It was in Charleston, but...
Actually, that would have been the South Carolina Historical Society. Some of their...
Yeah,
but that one was one that Fritz and I said, well, it's really about an issue that's not just South Carolina or the Civil War and Reconstruction. It was really about preservation of records, which is a great topic, but we could
sort of fall out of our specifics.
Well, maybe the association's next book ought to be South Carolina history in a world context.
Well, there's a board member who has begun the process of a compilation of the best articles on European history, and that one is sort of still in the creation stages. But we were under a time crunch to get this out for the sesquicentennial, so we made it into Reconstruction.
Yeah.
We didn't make it in time for the war.
Yeah. Well, the Reconstruction period certainly hasn't had the focus specifically on South Carolina that the war has.
No. There is an effort to try to make this state much more focused on Reconstruction than has been the case.
It's being headed by Larry Rowland and Steve Wise, the historians of Beaufort County, and with the support of the two congressmen who have Beaufort County in their district, and that's Mark Sanford and Jim Clyburn. It's to look at a number of sites in and around Beaufort and the Sea Islands, which were an integral part not just of South Carolina history, but American history, beginning, of course, with the occupation of Port Royal mm-hmm. in the fall of 1861, which resulted in that infamous council coming into mm-hmm. existence. So, I mean, it's a part of all of our history, and some people don't like to talk about Reconstruction.
I don't see why.
With the philosophy that has grown up, especially in the South, but nationally, as Walter's already pointed out, the idea that suddenly that we look at Reconstruction in a different light as having some positive aspects, and you know, if some of those positive attempts had actually been able to occur, maybe we've been in better shape now. Who knows? It's interesting you bring that up, because a few years ago you were at that conference up in High Hampton mm-hmm. Wade Hampton, and I had a paper about Wade Hampton and his political perspectives, and people were most of the audience, you know, were Hampton lovers and saw Hampton as, you know, someone who had redeemed the state, and were kind of, if maybe not appalled, but certainly rather upset that I would suggest that maybe he wasn't quite the redeemer that we have painted him to be.
Excuse me. What did you say specifically?
Well, I said that Wade Hampton was from the planter class, and he saw blacks as inferior. I mean, that is what any white planter would have believed, and he could not see African Americans as any more than secondary citizens who, if they participated, they would participate as he told them to. And if they didn't...
Well, now, he did appoint African Americans to office.
He did, but they didn't last very long. They slowly were whittled out of this regime by his beginning of his second term. There were very few left in there.
Well, of course, he went off to the Senate.
Well, he did. He was a sort of runoff by the new people coming in.
Who would run Wade Hampton?
Well, you have Benjamin Tillman, who's starting to make his move, although he doesn't really become a major player until later in the 1880s. But he and people of his ilk are making moves to throw out the redeemer, the old planter class, and bring in the more populist group of young political people that are, quote, more in tune with what the common man needs.
Fritz, you've used the term planter class. I think even in this day and time, we need to explain what you mean by the planter class.
Well, the planter class are those people that operated the major plantations in this state that usually had 20 or more slaves who worked their plantations, and most of them that, like Wade Hampton and the Singletons, they owned hundreds of slaves on different plantations, both here in South Carolina and in other parts of the South. Hampton's had a huge plantation in Mississippi where they had accumulated a large fortune along with their South Carolina holdings. These are the people that really control the antebellum government. They're the economic and political leaders of the state. In Hampton, after the war, I mean, he was a great general, probably certainly this state's, I think, preeminent leader in the Civil War. And after the war, he is struggling because he loses his fortune. He actually goes bankrupt. He tries to reconcile in some way with this new regime after some trepidation. I see him. And he does make some efforts to bring in some of the alternate, the black political regime. But he's got other people in Gary. Edgefield and Gary. They're absolutely appalled by the idea of any black participation.
What about the idea of the road not taken with Wade Hampton?
There are three excellent articles in this book that all deal with Wade Hampton and the election of 1876. One of them is from Fritz, so you've heard his take on it already. There are two others. One deals with Governor Chamberlain, the outgoing Republican governor, and the third is a kind of a history of the culture of the ballot box in 1876, and that one is real interesting as well. So it kind of is a historiographical section in and of itself of South Carolina at the end of Reconstruction, in particular dealing with Wade Hampton's gubernatorial race.
Yeah, I mean, Chamberlain is a fascinating character. I mean, he's a native of Ohio. He was an officer in the Union Army, and he comes down here. And from what I can understand, he had some ideals. He was hoping to bring both race groups of people together, and he was unable. He just couldn't succeed because the white power structure just did not want any kind of compromise. And Hampton seemed to be, he represented that old school that wanted to retake the political system and more or less return it to what it had been before 1861.
And the national political scene is important to understand, too. Now that I've been teaching Civil War and Reconstruction for over a decade, you know, of course, Fort Sumter's in there, and that's in South Carolina. And then at the end of the class, I returned to South Carolina for the 1876 election. But I began to realize I don't talk about South Carolina that much because we're off at Gettysburg and all these places. And that's what this book fulfilled for me was what happened in the middle.
Well, you have a remarkable phrase. South Carolina is the bookends for secession and the end of Reconstruction, with the Union troops being withdrawn, Chamberlain leaving the state, and Hampton occupying the governor's chair in 77. I guess South Carolina really is the perfect place for the bookends. The war began here, right? Secession started here, Reconstruction, and South Carolina, literally, the evacuation of troops, that was the last event of Reconstruction, was it not?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But you've got this very complicated story in between.
Yeah. I mean, the South Carolina during the war is trying to, you know, support it as much as it can. But as the struggle becomes, you know, more and more in favor of the Union, people are, you know, food and everything else is more and more scarce, and families are struggling. And they,
I mean, there was a bread riot in Columbia, just like there was in Richmond and Mobile and Savannah.
Right. When you read the governor's letters of letters to the governor in 1864 and 65, you know, they're writing, say, we need our husband, we need our son to come home. We cannot continue. And if we're going to survive, we have to have our menfolk here to help. And
well, since you mentioned Hampton, in the fall of 1864, his house on Landing Street was broken into, and anti-war graffiti was scrawled on the walls. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something. Gentlemen, need to pause for a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Fritz Hamer and Mike Bonner about Civil War and Reconstruction in South Carolina. All right, we were talking about the war being and Reconstruction being complicated, but the war was more complicated, Fritz, as we were saying. As the war dragged on and the death tolls came back daily, people don't realize that with the telegraph and the railroad, the death lists came back every day. And, for example, in Greenville, where the telegraph didn't always work, the list would go from Columbia up to Greenville, and there was a local man, when the news got there right at the station, he would stand on a platform and read the death list from Greenville every day.
Mm.
And the casualty figures, which the more research gets done, the higher they go. And percentage-wise, it's almost as high as 20%. I've seen 15 to 18% that's certainly documented. The stories that you hear about, well, Aunt Minnie never married because she lost her beau in the war. Well, there weren't any
beaux left.
Any beaux left. And the wounded, and you could figure three wounded for every killed, and the Confederate veterans after 1877, a good portion of the state budget of South Carolina goes for prosthetic devices for Confederate veterans.
Mm-hmm. South Carolina is one of the last southern states to form a Confederate home for veterans. But they start cropping up in the 1870s in Richmond and Louisiana. And these are destitute veterans. If you have an income, you're not going to be allowed generally into these places. But these are supported by the state for destitute veterans. And it's a small part of showing the devastation of this conflict.
It lasted until the 1950s.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's where Confederate Avenue gets its name.
Mm-hmm.
In Columbia. And there were, of course, pensions as well.
Yeah. Those begin in the 1880s. And they're not huge, but for the day, it was better than not getting anything. And then, of course, widows also. The last, I think, pension handed to a Confederate widow was in the 1980s, I think.
Yeah. And since there weren't a lot of young beaux around, one of the, and this has been in novels, you know, Last Confederate Widow, mm-hmm. and all of that, younger women married Confederate veterans because they might be the third wife, but if they survived him, they got the pension.
That's right.
Certainly.
And remember, South Carolina also had pensions for faithful slaves.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, that's an interesting bit. I haven't read a whole lot about that. Maybe you can illuminate
Well,
more.
That took place in the 20s. There were criteria of how that was defined, who were loyal, and they were able to
gain a pension.
A small pension.
Mm-hmm.
The other southern-wide issue that you mentioned, talked about the home for destitute veterans, the pensions, the help for prosthetic devices, memorial associations.
Oh, yeah. Those are huge. And their impact is still being felt today, I think, in terms of how we interpret this history, both Civil War and Reconstruction. And the United Daughters of the Confederacy are, you know, instrumental in making sure that the South gets the, quote, real history of the war. And they begin this in the 1890s. And it's, I think, endemic in just about every southern state right into the 1950s, if not further on. And what they were teaching or bringing to these schools remains still an important part of how most South Carolinians and Southerners, Native Southerners, look at the war.
Native white Southerners.
Native white Southerners. Good point.
Okay. And we're talking about the rise of the Lost Cause.
Yes.
One of the earliest monuments to the Confederacy is in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Soldier's Monument that's now on the State House grounds was dedicated in 1878.
Yeah, but there was one even earlier. I think it was in Darlington.
Okay. Well,
I'm not sure about that. So back to the fact that folks seem to shy away from Reconstruction. Mike, you were in graduate school later than Fritz and me, and you were in school out in California. Much interest in Civil War and Reconstruction?
There was quite a bit of interest in Civil War and Reconstruction. My two graduate professors had, one was in economics. My mentor is a professor of economic history, Roger Ransom. And the professor I took Reconstruction from had a very different view. And his intellectual development was during the 1960s and early 1970s during the Civil Rights Movement. So he was the exact opposite of the Dunning School, which is not a bad thing. But I do think there's a lot of interest in the Civil War in particular, and that's never going to go away. My students are always like, oh, the war's over. Can the semester be over? No. We have to talk about, and what arguably is more important, the legacy of the war and the formation of the modern United States, which does not start until 1865. the war makes for a bloody but neat package.
Neat? Oh, okay.
In terms of
I understand.
In terms of chronology, it has a beginning and an end. Reconstruction has a beginning, but does it have an end? Eric Foner's great book on Reconstruction, probably the seminal work right now for this generation of historians, calls the Reconstruction an unfinished revolution. If it's unfinished, when do we get to neatly package up and say Reconstruction is over? My students get very frustrated when I ask them that question, but that's why I ask them that. Have we completed Reconstruction? That makes them uncomfortable, and I think that speaks to why a lot of people feel uncomfortable talking about Reconstruction, because it's very clear that matters of equality, race, whether it's political or economic equality, have not been completely settled.
Well, throw the other unmentioned on the table, class.
Certainly.
I mean, people don't realize when they talk about Ben Tillman, when he campaigned for governorship, he campaigned against the Confederacy. He laughed at the men waving their empty sleeves. Now, of course, he himself was not a veteran.
No.
That's...
Even though he had a brother who was.
He had a brother. He always brought up his brother. Mm-hmm. But some of the things he said on the campaign trail in 1890 were vicious. These old men always looking backward.
Mm-hmm.
And he attacked Wade Hampton. And as soon as when Hampton came up for reelection, he saw that Hampton was bounced from the U.S. Senate because that was elected by the General Assembly. So as folks say today, it's a complicated issue.
Very much so.
Mike, you talked about when you were in graduate school. When I was in graduate school here, the man who did Civil War and Reconstruction was William Foran, an incredible teacher. He used to talk about the three Reconstructions, and part of this was reaction to Lewis Jones talking about the three secessions in South Carolina, 1719, 1776, and 1860. He said the three Reconstructions, the one we're talking about now, the New Deal, and the Civil Rights Movement, which we were just in the late 60s getting into. Bill Foran's pretty convincing that certainly the New Deal turned South Carolina around in a lot of ways, economically, socially, and then the Civil Rights Movement. But, you know, Eric's got an interesting argument. It's a great big book. It's, I read it. I like it. If you buy it and you don't like it, it makes a great doorstop along with South Carolina history. So... You know, but it's the complication of the issues that make it interesting, but also today make it a difficult area to study because everybody wants something. It's either yes or no.
Right. Especially in this day and age.
Yeah. It's either red or green.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't tell the story that if you're going to tell the story, you can't, you know, black or white, the shades of gray. There are more than 50 shades of gray when you deal with the Civil War and Reconstruction.
There are. And in terms of so-called redemption, when I cover that, and each state has a different pattern, but they're somehow similar, my students are confused by that as well. It's very complicated, very messy. And frankly, Americans don't like talking about these things unless they're forced to. We don't like to have to solve hard problems. We like quick wars. We like easy solutions. But life is not that way, and Civil War and Reconstruction teaches us that, if nothing else.
Well, it's taken a long time for us to really want to talk about some issues of the American Revolution. But I think that story is changing. People are understanding that the Revolution was a lot more complicated than just Paul Revere and and what have you.
Right.
I've
heard you talk about, Walter, and I mean, here in South Carolina, we had a Civil War.
Yes.
The Revolution.
Yep.
And it continued even after the British were thrown out to some degree.
And then it morphed until 1808. It morphed into a fight for political control between the Lowcountry elite and the rising backcountry until they compromised in 1808 on a fairly interesting way to do it. And they actually reapportioned the General Assembly every 10 years. That 1808 compromise became sacred. You didn't mess with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is by 1860, basically the planter class has won the state. because of the sweep of plantation slavery through South Carolina. And that's one thing we haven't mentioned is the demography. In 1860, South Carolina was 60% African American. Mm-hmm. Mississippi had a slight black majority, but no other southern state came close. Mm-mm. Mm-mm. And all but 10 counties or districts in the state had a black majority, and most of those that were a white majority were barely a white majority. A few exceptions. Greenville was pretty white. Mm-hmm. Pickens. But some of those others, York and that area, they were pretty close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that we don't usually think about today unless you read it, you look at the history of the state. And as what, South Carolina was a black majority state until about 1920.
1921.
Yeah.
So there's an interesting piece in there about desertion in the northwestern part of the state. A lot of Civil War historians, North Carolina is usually attached with the state of desertion. But there's a great piece in the book about desertion and the inability of the state government to control it.
The dark corner.
Dark corner.
Right. And obviously geography plays a huge factor in that. But there's also this idea that white South Carolinians were unanimously in favor of the Confederacy, and that simply doesn't bear out by some of the evidence.
Well, and again, part of this has to do with class.
Certainly.
And you have these letters where a Confederate private was paid $11 Confederate, and by 1863, that almost is what it costs for a loaf of bread. In your part of the country, in Lancaster, where you are, the Lancaster unit suffered tremendous casualties because, of course, they enrolled as the local militia units, mm-hmm. then became part of the Confederacy, mm-hmm. and they went off together. And mm-hmm. I think it was over 20% of the Lancaster.
That sounds correct. The 2nd South Carolina recruited in the area, Lancaster Invincibles. Mm-hmm. We just got their flag at the county courthouse.
And there's an older article, not in your collection, on losses by particular units, and I think you're going to find South Carolina units are going to be in those very heavily. Maxey's Brigade, for example. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the story, too. Go back to the Piedmont farmer, and this woman's trying to manage. It's a farm. They do have half a dozen slaves, and she's interested in survival, and she doesn't care what the government's trying to do.
Right.
And she wants her husband home.
Yeah. There are a lot of good articles in there about the regular people of South Carolina, the desertion issue, aid societies for soldiers that communities put together. There's a lot of good information on that. One article stuck out in my mind about the creation of the police force in Charleston in 1865.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
Trying to use African-American police officers in Charleston. How did that play out? Just fascinating stories of real people.
Local histories that don't usually get lost.
The common soldier brought to mind, Fritz, Tracy Powers' book, Lee's Miserables, which is about the entire army. But the South Carolina letters that he has in there
That is a fascinating read. And one of those, he's one of the few that has really delved into that and shown how difficult it was for these common soldiers to stay on the line in Petersburg.
Well, Mike, you mentioned the aid groups. If you want to look at the women's roles, you've got Mary Elizabeth Massey's Ersatz and the Confederacy of folks at home trying to survive.
Well, you know, the other thing that I recently discovered was the efforts to find natural medicinal compounds out in the woods, forest, that they would bring into Columbia to try to refine, because they couldn't get anywhere near what they needed locally or from overseas. And there's some interesting material that needs to be explored further in that regard. Now, there's lots more to be found about the home front and how the people dealt with all these privations and tried to survive until the war was over.
Then, of course, when the war is over, and you've already mentioned the women and the UDC, when the men come back, first of all, they've lost. And today we say of a lot of those veterans who had PTSD. Well, Uncle Fritz came back from the war. He was never right. Or he became an alcoholic. There are glimpses clearly of what
severe depression. They didn't call it that at the time. Melancholia.
They call, yes.
And, Mellon. And that's a huge factor in all of this, that it's very hard to document other than these general non-medical terms that are used in the letters you mentioned. Mm-hmm.
But having to cope with the loss, the women were some of the most outspoken, you know, their actual description of hatred for the Yankees.
Oh, definitely. Very clearly.
Well, that speaks to, and from the comfort of the 21st century, we like to just look and judge people who have written in the past, but they live through it, and that bitterness makes sense. How could you not be bitter? Both sides, Union families of dead Union soldiers, Southern families who had someone with PTSD or missing a limb and were no longer valuable on their small farm. I mean, this is not something that the country could put behind them. And
well, what about the Reconstruction period, in which freedmen and women had, for a time period, civil rights, and then all of a sudden that disappears? I mean,
no question. And they are also trying to struggle with the legacy of slavery itself. And then there's a flash of opportunity, which is suddenly taken away from them. Yeah, devastating.
Well, see, that was one thing you talked about. When did Reconstruction end? It ended in other states a lot earlier than it did in South Carolina.
Yes, Virginia, really before it got started. Tennessee never really had to go through Reconstruction.
And Louisiana?
Louisiana, Florida, South Carolina, roughly the same period. North Carolina, 1870. Alabama, 1874. Mississippi, 1875. There have been some recent historians to say there's a recipe for Southern redemption. There's something to it, but I'm not sure it bears the details out. One common ingredient, of course, is white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic Party's determination to regain power. There's no question about that. But each state does have a different story. North Carolina's story is quite different from South Carolina's story.
And then there was the Mississippi Plan.
The Mississippi Plan.
Based upon violence.
Right.
And that's what Butler took as a model for South Carolina.
Which Butler, Fritz?
Matthew Butler.
Okay. Another Edgefield person?
Another Edgefield man.
And see, you've got Gary, you've got a lot of this violence comes out of Edgefield. And it was often referred to by other South Carolinians, white and black, as Edgefield, bloody Edgefield.
Mm-hmm.
All right. This is always difficult to ask an author. Fritz, what is your favorite essay in the book, your favorite article?
I guess I find Dan Carter's article about the failed effort, or failed Southern to realize, you know, how they could not adapt to the post-war period without going back to the white dominance.
Let's remind folks who Dan Carter is.
Well, Dan Carter is a historian who spent many years at Emory University and then in his later years came back here to South Carolina.
A Florence native.
A Florence native, whose, I guess, most well-known work is The Rage of Southern Politics about George Wallace. That's an amazing study looking at Wallace and his career and, you know, its trajectory. It's quite something. But this article that Dan Carter did was really looked at the beginning of the idea of, segregation that would eventually become the law of the land and why Southerners could not reconcile the loss of the war.
White Southerners.
White Southerners.
Yeah. And Mike, what about you?
I particularly liked an article by Christopher Mikau about the bombardment of Charleston in 1863 and 64.
Who is Professor Mikau?
I have never had the pleasure to meet him.
He was a Park Service ranger at the Fort Sumter National Site. And we tried to find out more about him, but he left Charleston before we started working on this, and we have not been able to track him down.
We did our best to track down all the authors, but he apparently has moved on. One reason I like that article a lot is because Civil War historians think they've covered everything. And when I read that article, I was fascinated. He talks about the rules of war and the bombardment of cities in the 1860s, what was allowed under the rule of law and what was not. And he talks briefly about Vicksburg and Petersburg, two of the most famous cities that were under Union siege. He says that's allowable because there's an army actually in between, protecting the city. But he says Charleston, when Union General Quincy Gilmore decided to bombard Charleston, was completely against all the rules of war because he issued an ultimatum, either surrender the city or I'm going to open fire on the civilians inside the city. And Confederate General Beauregard says, no, you can't do that. But I don't think very many Civil War historians or historians of the Civil War in South Carolina realize that that was so outrageous. He makes the point that the first shell killed an over 80-year-old man on Christmas Day. How depressing is that?
All right, gentlemen, I'm sorry. AT is giving us the wind-up sign. Any last word for our listeners before we sign off? And Fritz, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I think this group of essays is an important look at local history in the Civil War and Reconstruction era that often gets overlooked, certainly for South Carolina. And if you want to know some more about this war from a local perspective and also often from that of the common man, these articles help tell that story.
Okay. Mike?
Oh, sure. I would like to just mention that when we say articles, we're talking about an 8 to 10-page article. They're not 40 or 50-page articles, and the variety is what I'm really pleased with. If you're into military history, there's something for you. If you're into social history, there's something for you.
All right. Well, Fritz Hamer and Mike Bonner, I want to thank you gentlemen for being with us today on Walter Edgar's Journal.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal and learned something. I know I did. I had no idea that the bombardment of Charleston contravened what was considered the norms or the rules of warfare in the 19th century. This collection of essays tells you a lot about the story of everyday men and women in South Carolina, not just the generals and the governors. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of the Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.